Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for real estate investors looking to protect their assets, save on taxes, and build their wealth with Clint Coons. Clint is an attorney, author, avid real estate investor, and featured instructor at Anderson's tax and asset protection events held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone. Hi, it's Clint Coons here with Anderson Business Advisors, and this is another edition of our weekly podcast. You know, today what I thought I'd do, starting out the new year, is that a lot of people are out there flipping real estate. It's been a hot topic for the last couple of years with the real estate prices going up. People were jumping into various markets and finding ways to make money. But what I've discovered in working with real estate flippers all across the country for the past 3 to 4 years is that there are those people that find a way, a niche to really go out there and kill it. And there's other people that struggle. And they often wonder, you know, what is it that makes a difference between what I'm doing and what this other person is doing where they have found success in their flipping? Well, it just so happens in my backyard, there is such an individual that has been flipping property in the Pacific Northwest, and they've done extremely well with it, and they've developed some systems around it. And I thought, you know, what better way than to have this individual on the program, on the podcast, to talk about their success. They have their own podcast. They give away tons of free information. It's something that you're going to definitely want to sign up for if you're considering flipping real estate, just to follow these individuals. But without any further ado, I just want to introduce Tucker Merrihue of TTM Development. Tucker, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on the show, Clint. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're finally here. I know it took a while for us to get together to get you on the podcast, but now that you're here, I think it's perfect timing for everyone. And as we were just talking about before we got started, they were complaining about snow down there, and you said you didn't get much. So did you hunker in today? Or are you guys still out there hitting the streets and looking for
deals? We managed to make it into the office with just a few snowflakes flying by. So Snowmageddon didn't quite happen. So I'm here, we're cranking, trying to get after it here in 2020.
Do you have any snowflakes at work for you that couldn't make it into the office because they saw two flecks on the ground?
I try not to hire snowflakes. So
Yeah. You can always tell the character of an employer, right? Oh, I see a snowflake on my lawn, so I can't make it in today.
Yeah, fortunately, I've got guys that are not quite wired that way.
Yeah.
So I'm fortunate in that regard.
Well, there's a key right there to building a successful business and flipping, having the right employees.
That's right. Yeah. Most of the guys that we'll dive into it, but you know, Chris, who's in the office next to me, he's been with me for about 10 years. Dan in the office next to him has been with me for about 7. And then the guys in the field have been with me for a long time too. So yeah, we've got a business of some long tenured employees and, you know, a good team that we built here over that time.
Well, to build a team like that, I mean, you know, can you explain how you got started in this business?
Sure. You know, let's take it back to, I guess, probably 2007. It was like August 2007. Maybe it was August 2000. Anyway, I had a mortgage company previously, and I was doing some flipping on the side. I was doing some kind of what they now coin as house hacking. Back then, there wasn't, you know, such a cool name for it. It was just called buying a house, living in it, fixing it up, getting roommates, and then selling it for a profit, right? After 2 years and taking that money tax-free. So I did one of those on the run-up in the last cycle. Bought it in 2002, sold it just before 2006, made about 200 grand. Did that on a couple of other, you know, investment type properties. I bought a hoodie duplex that I put some tenants in, cleaned it up a little bit, made about 80 grand on that one, flipped a couple condos. So I did some stuff on the side in addition to building a mortgage company. But in, you know, late 2007, the world changed in terms of the mortgage markets and just the world of mortgage lending, and then ultimately the world of real estate. And so that was kind of the point, I guess, the jump off point that I really needed to kind of go full time into the real estate investment and development side of the business. Previously, I was kind of, you know, one foot in, one foot out because the mortgage company was creating good income for me. But I was also doing really well in the real estate that I was doing. Now, of course, the market was, you know, on fire, and, you know, you could pretty much be a monkey throwing darts and probably do pretty well with real estate back then. But, you know, that being said, I still did well with it. But I had a hard time letting go of the time commitment of the mortgage company because it was also paying me well. But once the, you know, mortgage markets imploded and the world of real estate changed forever in late 2007, early 2008, I then decided to kind of go full bore into the world of, you know, at that point it was house flipping because new construction price points just weren't quite there in most of Portland. So we had to get into the world of just flipping. And so I started TTM Development back in the end of 2008. And here we are 2020, 12 years later. You know, we started, you know, in the simple ways of buying. We bought REOs off the MLS. We did short sales, you know, people that had too much debt that needed to be negotiated down. And instead of going to foreclosure, you know, we had an in-house short sale negotiator. Then eventually we started buying at auction as well. And then eventually we segued to the world of direct-to-seller marketing about 2010, once those other lead sources started to get a little more competitive and it wasn't quite as easy to get deals. And for about, you know, 9 years now, we've been, you know, almost exclusively in the world of direct seller marketing in terms of creating our opportunities and our deals to buy.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned REOs and auctions, because I know a lot of real estate investors, they think they're just going to go to auction and that's where they're going to find properties. But that's a tough game to try to make profit at. The way I understand it.
It is. You know, back in the day, it was different, right? Because now there's a lot more technology in this business. There's a lot more service providers. You know, back then, there were no bidding services, right? It was like the usual suspects down at the auction block. And so you were basically bidding against the same 5 or 6 guys every time. And there was some shenanigans that would go on. And, you know, it depend on who was full up that week and who wasn't, as to who ultimately ended up, you know, being able to walk away with more deals in any given week. But once the bidding services came in, you know, there was like a never ending supply of buyer money to buy at the steps. And so it just became a lot more difficult. And nowadays, you know, that same thing applies. You can still fish deals out of there, but it's definitely more difficult. It's more competitive and the margins are more compressed than they were before.
Yeah, that's what I saw too. We used to flip properties in the Las Vegas market and we started doing it in 2010. And it was great there. We were mainly working with REO deals, but eventually it dried up for us because our returns, we just couldn't get the returns we were looking for because of the bidding. People were coming in and just bidding it up. And we just said, you know, it's not worth it to go chasing after these deals for such low margin.
Yeah. I mean, here, that was the same thing. You know, for a while, it was kind of like just low hanging fruit, right? You'd watch an REO. Either you got to know the REO agents in town and they would hook you up with deals before they hit the market. And they put it in as pending. If you were able to get the price that they suggested to the bank and the bank was happy just having it go pending, or you played the game of, okay, has it been on the market 60 days, 90 days? Has it had a sale fail? You know, is there some room there for the bank to negotiate? And then you kind of come in and clean up the mess on those. So those were kind of our two angles to get REOs. But eventually, as you said, there just was a lot more competition that came in. And, you know, REO investing was, there was no marketing dollars that needed to be spent on them. So, you know, it was a very low barrier of entry for when people started to get back into the world of real estate investing. And that's why most of the competition, that was kind of their first stop. That's where they landed. And that's why a lot of those prices started to get bid up. And it was just more difficult to find deals, like you said, with enough room, with enough margin to make it all worth it.
Okay. So you said something now that since that area kind of dried up for you, you've gone more to this direct to consumer marketing strategy.
Well, I call it direct to seller. I mean, I guess, you know, seller is a consumer too at the end of the day, but, you know, direct to seller would be somebody who owns real estate, whether it be inherited, whether it be long-term ownership, whether it be rental property, whatever it is, right? So you're basically cutting out any intermediaries in between you and that owner. And so, you know, our first attempt at doing this was pretty simple, fairly unsophisticated. We bought a list. It was at the time, I think it was called the inherited property list, and it was kind of new to the market. And we just sent yellow letters to it. And I mean, I remember I sent out like 300 yellow letters and I probably got 60 calls. I mean, it was crazy response rate, but back then nobody was getting those and nobody was doing any mailing. So it was kind of a new thing in the market. And because of that, you know, our response rates were off the charts and it was really easy to go fish deals out of that pond as well. Now it's tightened up quite a bit, especially over the last probably 3 years with, you know, the advent of, you know, a lot more wholesalers and more technology type wholesaling businesses that have kind of come into this space and they're trying to scale and do large volumes and all those things. So it's definitely got more difficult as well, but we've remained, you know, fairly competitive in that space and we continue to pull deals out of it, but we've had to, you know, change our strategy slightly. We've, you know, had to pivot a little bit. We've had to spend a little more than we used to. You know, all those things just that happen with competition.
Yeah. So are you still with the yellow letter campaign or are you finding something else works a little better?
We abandoned yellow letters probably 5 years ago, maybe 6.
Okay.
Just because, you know, there were so many companies that actually started popping up that's, you know, Yellow Letters HQ, Yellow Letters Direct,
you know,
Yellow Letters everything, right? So we, again, tried to reinvent ourselves and be different, try and have something different. You know, when you have 7 or 8 investors sending to the same list with the exact same copy, with the exact same letter, it makes it challenging to stand out. And it really is just, you know, a numbers game of, you know, are they getting your letter on the day that they want to call? And they probably think you're the same guy that mailed them six times before, really. So we changed our marketing piece to try and stand out, make it look different. We don't really do yellow letters, but we do, you know, same type of concept, a lot of handwritten stuff, a lot of, you know, crazy packaging, some grabber pieces, just some direct mail tricks to kind of get people's attention, keep their attention, and ultimately get them to call us first if they're going to call somebody, so we can at least have, you know, first run at any property.
Yeah, that is key when it comes to marketing. I think that's the thing that a lot of people who have entered this space that want to flip real estate or wholesaling real estate, they don't necessarily get that you need to stand out from your competition. So these people that you're targeting, they're getting hit by, you know, 10, 20, 30 different other investors. And, you know, I often tell people if they're asking me about it, I said, they should be split testing. They should be marketing, you know, trying one thing out and then trying something out and see which is getting the greater return rate on it, which I'm sure you're doing as well, because you just never know what's going to attract the seller to give you the call.
Yeah. I mean, we've been tweaking, testing, retesting, tweaking, you know, over the years. And, you know, I studied direct mail pretty intently too, you know, over the course of the last 10 years and just kind of all the tricks and things that people do to have success with it. Cause we're not the only industry that uses it by any means. And I've taken a lot of the strategies and ideas that are used in other industries and kind of applied them to the real estate world. And, you know, that's worked out well. So, you know, I haven't reinvented the wheel. I've just taken a wheel that's been invented in other spaces and applied it to real estate.
That's amazing you say that, because that's one of the things that I myself have done. You know, we get it in what we call junk mail that comes in. My wife used to always throw it away, and I would tell her, no, don't throw that stuff away. Save it for me. Because I would go through it, and I still do it to this day, and I keep a folder, and I look at it, and I say, what catches my eye that I would then not toss, and I would make me want to open it? And I use that many times as the templates for the stuff that I work on. And just seeing how that would respond in, you know, in my particular space. Do you ever done something similar like that?
It's funny you say that, because I have a file cabinet to my right, and within that file cabinet is a giant folder, and that giant folder has all that mail.
So, yeah, I know.
I get it all the time as well.
See, that's what people say. Well, how do I come up with this stuff? I said, somebody's already doing it for you. All you have to define is just find it and then just re-engineer it. You know, it's a gift that keeps on giving. Take it and make it your own.
Yeah, and everybody's. You know, you might be able to tweak things slightly, but, you know, there's guys that send, you know, hundreds and thousands of direct mail pieces a month in different industries. And, you know, they know all the different things. You know, they've tried everything. You know, they know what people respond to the best at different points and this and that. And so, you know, that information's out there. Those pieces are out there. You just can take them and kind of tweak them for the industry that we're in.
So when you're looking for a property, is there any certain criteria that you go through?
Yeah, we have kind of three buckets, right? In terms of like what our business does to actually make money. You know, we've been talking about marketing, which costs money, but what do we do to actually make money? And the biggest bucket is kind of our, we'll call it our redevelopment, our new construction, you know, part of the business or arm of the business. And that's kind of our longest term money. And when we look for those types of properties, we're generally looking in the nicer parts of town, you know, higher price points, generally $1 million plus for new construction. And so we're also looking for houses, you know, within those areas. There's not a lot of like vacant land in Portland, right? We have an urban growth boundary. Most of the land within that has already been developed at some point. So what we look for is like older housing that's outlived its useful life. Maybe it's older housing on a bigger lot so that maybe two units could be put where there was previously one or three units. And so we target those types of properties for that bucket. And that served us really well. And we'll buy them, we'll tear down the existing house, either build one in its place or two or three, depending on the zoning and how many lots can be created or whether or not we think we should make multiple lots there. The second bucket is our renovation bucket. So we basically buy houses, renovate and put them back on the market. So essentially flipping, right? You know, like the HGTV type. And that will go, you know, down in price point a little bit, you know, more, we'll call it median price point, you know, anywhere between 400 and $1 million for the existing construction bucket. And we'll renovate those and we'll put those to market and sell them. And that's usually a little quicker. The new construction bucket takes anywhere between 8 and 12 months, you know, to turn over your money and generate a profit. The rehab bucket takes anywhere between 3 and 4 months usually. So it's a little quicker turn. And then our third bucket is wholesale. So anytime that we're, you know, maxed out in terms of the amount of projects we're doing or the amount of capital that we've got deployed or the bandwidth that we have available, then we start wholesaling. But we also wholesale in areas where I don't necessarily want to have my crew drive every day. It's just not convenient to where our other projects are. And so we just wholesaled one in Southeast Portland, you know, last week that we could have very easily renovated it, but we generated a great check on the front end, you know, doing nothing. And we don't have any other projects there right now. And I didn't want to have this kind of outlier project. So we wholesale as well. So, you know, those are kind of our three buckets. And, you know, we generally fill up the development bucket first. We do as many rehabs as we can do. And then we go to the wholesale bucket once we're at capacity.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
So in that Southeast Portland deal, I mean, were you actively then, I would assume, marketing in that area? And just wondering if you would get enough volume there to make it worth your while to go into that area? Or how did you end up there?
Yeah, so the way that we market is we have the city kind of mapped out. And so over the years, we've driven every neighborhood that we feel is a good place to be marketing and doing deals. Even if we're going to wholesale, it doesn't mean that, doesn't mean that it's a bad area or that people don't want to rehab there, because, I mean, we sold that property in Southeast Portland with one phone call. So it's definitely a hot rehab area, just not an area that's convenient to everything that we have going on. So we market all over. In the wholesale bucket, we'll market in a lot of areas that, you know, we wouldn't want to market to keep, but it allows us to market in a larger geographical area. In terms of paying for that marketing, you know, the one that we sold last week, we made $25,000 on the front end of a wholesale deal. So, you know, our margins are good. And that then substantiates quite a bit of marketing that we can allocate on those types of profits. We wholesaled one a week before that, and we made $50,000 on it. So, you know, you can kind of continue the marketing machine with a portion of those profits fairly easily.
Sure.
We're not like I wouldn't say that we're like a monster marketing house like some of these large scale operations are that are spending $40,000, $50,000 a month on marketing. You know, we're more in like the probably $6,000 a month, $7,000 a month range on our marketing costs.
So with those markets that you're talking about where you're marketing to, do you typically what drive them? I mean, how do you determine where you want to drop mail?
Yeah, so that's, I guess, getting back to what I was going to mention previously. You know, we started doing driving for dollars back in like 2010, 2011. Back then it was very archaic, just kind of like the yellow letter, right? But we would have yellow notepads and we'd drive around and we write down addresses. And then we'd try and figure out, okay, what's the most efficient way to write down addresses and streets? So we'd put like a street name at the top and then we just put numbers all the way down, right? And then I'd have to hire like a high school kid or somebody that wouldn't mind working for $10 an hour at the time, come in the office and basically pull public records, create an Excel file with all of the owner information for each property. So then we could merge it, mail them. And eventually I thought to myself, you know, technology was starting to advance 2011, 12. And I was like, you know, and apps were kind of a thing. I was like, there's got to be a way to really simplify this process. And so we started on this journey of building what is now the Driving for Dollars app. And it wasn't an easy process. And, you know, back then it was much more difficult. There weren't as many good app builders and coders. So we've had a few iterations of this particular app, but now we use that app every day or every week still in our own business. But we've built, you know, probably about 35,000 property universe using our Driving for Dollars app, you know, driving all of these different pockets and neighborhoods and areas within the Portland metro area that we want to market in, whether it be for the new construction bucket, the rehab bucket, or the wholesale bucket. And then we continually market to those 35,000 properties, you know, at different times, depending on what it is that, you know, which bucket we want to fill up.
So that Drivings for Dollar app that you made, that you produce, and it's available, as I understand it, on the Apple Store and on Google, correct? For both Android and,
correct.
And
yeah,
iPhone?
There's an iTunes version and an Android version, which if you'd asked me 7 years ago if you needed two versions of an app, I wouldn't. Yes, you need both versions, and so it's available to both.
And then it works all across the country?
It does. So we API in skip trace data and you know, owner records data all across the country in every state. So basically, if you live in, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, or you live in Portland, Oregon, or you live in somewhere in Texas or wherever, Florida, you can use the app and you can basically build lists, have those lists immediately skip traced, and then you can upload those lists to your computer or to your direct mail provider or your ringless voicemail provider or your cold caller or whatever it is, and then take that information and market to those properties that you've identified as ones that should be bought by an investor or something that you're interested in.
Wow. I mean, for people listening in right now, you just gave a ton of information there about how you would take data like that and go after and hit a market. You know, you could hit multiple different ways other than just direct mail. So I hope people are listening in or picking up on that. And so, yeah, definitely you should check out that app. Sounds like it's a great piece of information, or actually it's a great tool that you could use to help grow your business. Now, when it comes to buying real estate and flipping real estate, one of the problems that a lot of people run into is funding. You know, where does the money come from to rehab the property? Or sometimes they don't even have the money to buy the property and they have to use a hard money lender. I'm sure you're beyond that point right now, but for those people who are getting started, is there any tips that you would recommend or advice you would tell them about how to help get their business funded?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we're beyond it. I would say it's the last bucket that we go to, right? In terms of, you know, cost of capital is something that me as the, you know, the guy that's basically responsible for running the business, I have to be aware of our cost of capital in any given project. And so obviously we want to use our cheapest capital first and our most expensive capital last. And so for us, the way that it works is, you know, we have our own internal capital that we use. I know a lot of people are like, oh, I always use other people's money. But, you know, we've been doing this for 12 years. And so at a certain point, you have to put your own money to work too. And so we put that to work first and foremost, because it's free capital. You know, there's opportunity costs of not investing in elsewhere, but it's basically cost-free capital. Then after that, we have a fair bit of private money that we've raised. And then after that, we'll go to hard money for some of the acquisition funds or things like that if we need to. And, you know, we're in a higher price point market, so you can eat up $2, $3 million worth of, you know, capital very easily in a couple of projects. So, you know, you got to raise a lot of money here to really be able to do a large number of projects. But to get back to your question, you know, the best way that we found to raise money is twofold. Number one is, and I know not everybody's an advocate of this, but for me personally, and something that everybody can do, is that if you have a house, right, and you have a fair bit of equity in your home, I started off using like a line of credit or a home equity line of credit on my house to free up some capital. Over time, you know, I've done the house hacking thing about 5 or 6 times over now. And so I have a house that's paid for, and we have, you know, $1 million plus line against the house. And I use that line as I want to. Now, you don't necessarily need that much, but if you have a house that has maybe $200,000 in equity, you might be able to get, you know, a good portion of that on a home equity line of credit. So that's a great way to raise money. Maybe you can't do the full acquisition and rehab, but at least you have some cash there, some runway to work with. Another great way that we've raised money is, again, going back to our direct mail strategy, but we pull a list of people that have lent on other property in our market as an individual and not as a company. So we pull a list, it's called a deed of trust list. And within that deed of trust list, which is basically a list of mortgages against properties, but the deed of trust has an individual as the beneficiary and not a company. And so usually it's a lesser sophisticated type of lender. They're usually doing something for like a, I don't know, a family member or friend. And we mail those people and we would say, hey, we know that you've done some deed of trust investing before. If you're interested in it again, we'd love to talk. And that's been a great source to find people who understand the deed of trust investment vehicle. And they're comfortable with the idea because they've done it before. And then we just kind of show, look, you can do this more at scale with us as opposed to kind of a onesie twosie thing. And that's been really successful for us in raising money.
So that's private money. It's not hard money. And so you're probably getting a much better interest rate with those types of lenders than you are going out to the HML market.
Yeah, exactly. The idea is it's a cheaper cost of capital, right? And then also, you know, you can structure it however you want. So we generally have, you know, they'll pay for full acquisition and full rehab if we want to, and they'll also accrue payments, right? So it's all paid upon payoff. So that makes it, you know, much easier for a lot of people that maybe, you know, they have cash flow challenges or things like that along the way. They don't want to have to be making those payments as they go.
Do you ever give them equity?
No, never give them equity. Just accrue and pay off.
Yeah, because I've seen a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll want to give equity away in the deal for the money. And do you have any thoughts on that? Well, you've never done it or you don't do it?
I just, in the world of single family, I don't think you need to. You know, the turnover is quick enough a lot of times, especially in the renovation world, that I think, you know, you're giving away too much if you're giving away equity. You know, I don't know what the equity equates to, right? At the end of the day, it compared to a return, depending on what you've negotiated in terms of rate or point rate and points, whatever it is. But I tend to think that, you know, if you keep it as, you know, interest rate and maybe a point or whatever it is, you keep them in the I'm the lender bucket and not the I'm a partner bucket. And once they get into the partner bucket, now all of a sudden people tend to have more opinions, and I just don't have more opinions.
So. Yeah, you don't want them telling what you should be doing. So when it comes to these deals, you know, you've got your own crew, but I've seen so many flippers in the last 2 years lose a ton of money, not because the deal didn't pencil and they didn't do their numbers right. It's because the contractors flaked on them. And it's just this reoccurring problem where you get a contractor in there and then they find a better deal for themselves. They drop off your project, you quit showing up, and they move on to something else. And you're stuck trying to scramble to put this deal together. And plus, you still got the money going out on the interest on the hard money loan that you took to fund it. Any words of advice for people when it comes to dealing with contractors, finding a good contractor?
Yeah. You know, the investor space is a funny one, right? Because we want everything done for cheap, generally. Mm-hmm. That's probably the biggest curse that investors have, is they're too big of cheapskates a lot of times. But the problem is when you kind of marry that world with the world of general contracting, you know, general contractors make the most money and subcontractors then make the most money when they're working for homeowners, right? Like that's the most money, but it's also a little bit bigger pain in the ass generally because people live in the house, right? Comes with just more babysitting, more handholding, more, you know, late night phone calls, things like that. But when you're dealing with the cheapskate contractor or investor, a lot of those same headaches still apply, but they're not making nearly as much money. So it's easy for them to deviate from your job and try and go find something that pays more for the same amount of headache. And so I would say you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you go and you look for your Craigslist contractors and you find you value cheap over everything else, you're probably going to have issues, whether that's them showing up when they say they are and you know, screwing up your schedule, or whether that's quality of work, whether that's coming back to fix anything that maybe they didn't do right. You know, you're going to get those problems. And I don't think people realize that. You know, you get one or the other. You get quality or you get cost. So you got to pick one, or you got to try and find somebody in the middle. For us, you know, we're our own GC. I hold the general contractor license I have for 10 plus years, but we sub out virtually everything. And we basically run the business as, you know, a GC type business. And what I found is that good subs kind of flock together. And so that's how we've kind of built our, you know, fleet of subs, is that, and most of them we found working new construction mainly. And then we get them to kind of splinter off from that and do a lot of our rehab stuff as well. But a lot of the rehab contractors in town that just purely work on rehabs and things like that, they're usually kind of the more scab guys, aren't quite as reliable, don't do quite as good a work. So we've tried to find the new construction guys and really funnel them to our rehab projects as well. They're not the cheapest, but they do a great job. They don't screw up our schedule. They come back and fix stuff. So you kind of have to weigh that, right? Do you want somebody that's good, or do you want somebody that's cheap? And you just have to kind of go into it eyes wide open.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting take, is to go out to the new construction sites and start talking to the subs that are out there. You know, we have a client in Texas. He actually had to hire security for his construction sites. And when I ask people, you know, why do they think that is? I mean, well, actually, if I ask you, why do you think that is?
Well, they're getting stolen from, obviously.
Yeah, but what are they stealing?
Well, probably supplies.
Yeah.
You know,
copper.
Yeah. Right? I mean, we've had to do the same, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a big problem here in Portland. And, you know, I'm not going to get political on your show, but we have a big homeless problem. And with that comes a lot of drugs, it comes a lot of riffraff, and it comes a lot of people that break into houses and steal stuff. And so, yeah, we've had to do that on a number of projects, just because, you know, we'll have people watching the house, and the day that we drop off fixtures is the night that they break into it, right?
Wow.
So we don't put up, like in Southeast Portland, for example, the reason why we wholesaled that deal is, you know, we've done a lot of projects in Southeast Portland that we've kept and renovated or built. We don't put for sale signs up. We don't put signs up at all, because that usually indicates a vacant house, and a vacant house is much easier to break into than one that's not. So yeah, we've dealt with a lot of the same stuff over the years here. And, you know, it's a problem. It definitely is. But the other thing too, is that with some of these bad contractors, just to kind of go full circle here, is that, you know, I've had my suspicions over the years, but you hire some sketchy guys that have the lockbox combo on a project. Who's to say that sketchy guys don't have sketchy friends, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of the way it works. So, and we found that to be the case, you know, as well. So that's a risk that you run when you hire kind of the bottom of the barrel guys as well.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
Well, it's funny. Okay, so you gave me the answer that everyone gives me. The real reason why he hired the security is because people are coming and stealing his subs, his employees.
Wow.
They would drive up in a truck, he said, and he would have, you know, six guys out on the job, and they'd say, "Hey, how much is that guy paying you?" And he'd say, "Oh, we're getting paid $20 an hour. I'll pay you $25. Drop everything you're doing right now. Jump in the back of my truck." And away they would go. And he'd show up at his project and sub would be there and he's got no employees working for him. And he said, "Somebody just came and took them all." That's how bad it is.
There's a big problem there. Number one is, you know, there's a big supply issue as far as workers. But number two is, I don't know, maybe he needs to spend a little more time building relationships with his workers.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
There's nobody on my job site that would leave for a few bucks more. They might say, "Hey, you know, we could make more money, or maybe the bids are higher next time, or maybe they ask for a raise or something like that." But I'm not going to get anybody that jumps ship like that. And so I would say he probably needs to spend a little more time on his job sites building a relationship with his guys.
Yeah, funny. But you're right about the homeless problem. I mean, yeah, Portland's got it worse probably than I don't know if it has it worse than Seattle.
I think we do. I mean, I've argued with people over this, but I went to Seattle a few weeks ago, you know, to speak at an event and kind of see some other real estate guys. And, you know, it's not good up there for sure, but man, it is not good down here at all.
You got crazies down there that, you know, they're homeless and crazies.
Yeah. We got the trifecta.
Yeah. I know.
Crazy and drug addicts. So yeah, it's a big problem down here, and it's bleeding over and it's affecting real estate now in a lot of neighborhoods. I mean, that's one reason why we refuse to build new construction in Southeast Portland, because I'm afraid that, you know, we start a project and we're going to try and exit this thing at 900,000, you know, or, you know, 800,000, a million bucks. And if a homeless camp decides to pop up, you know, on the sidewalk in front of this house, the city will not remove them. And, you know, we're going to have a really tough time selling a house with the homeless camp either in front of it or, you know, across the street from it or wherever. So it's becoming a bigger problem, you know, not just in terms of the homeless, but it's starting to affect, you know, other people in business and commerce as well.
Yeah. Well, they call it homeless and really they're just drug addicts that need treatment, but they try to.
We decided to make it legal to possess drugs here too. So that didn't help. So.
Yeah. Pretty soon they're going to go like California and make it legal to steal as long as it's under a certain threshold.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they say keep Portland weird, right? Well,
yeah. Hey, so where do you think the market's going 2020?
You know, it's an interesting question. Everybody wants to know. I really don't see much changing before the election. I think that, you know, the first half of 2020 will be very strong still. You know, we have an interesting thing here in Portland. It's called the urban growth boundary, which limits the amount of new housing supply that can be put to market. We also have a ton of bureaucracy and costs and hoops and hurdles to create new housing units even within that. So it's very difficult to expand the supply dramatically, you know, not only in our metro, but in a lot of metros across the country. And it's also extremely costly. So, you know, I think there's three major functions that will affect the market: supply, demand, and interest rate. And I know historically interest rates don't have a big impact, but I think because we've had low interest rates for so long, it's now priced into the asset to some extent, especially in higher priced metros. And so, you know, if interest rates stay about the same, there isn't a huge amount of supply coming to the market. Most people that are living in existing homes aren't necessarily going to sell just to sell, because it's going to be kind of a horizontal move. They might, you know, realize some equity, but they're not going to be able to get as much house for the money, you know, moving. So I think a lot of people are going to stay still, and there's not going to be a huge amount of supply that gets injected into the market. So for me, I think 2020 is probably a lot like 2019. And I don't see anything major happening. I think, you know, there might be some, you know, speed up, slow down along the way a little bit, but nothing major in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. It seems to be everything's pretty good as normal. So, you know, just in parting, so the new investor just getting started, is there any some things that they should just be focused on, would you say, that are must-dos?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing when you first start is just, it's very difficult to find deals on, you know, the low hanging fruit sources right now, right? Unless you're well connected. You know, it's taken us years to become well connected in the world of realtors here in town. We've done a variety of things to do that. But if you're new to the game and you're getting in, chances are you're not just going to stumble across a smoking deal that, you know, a realtor's got their claws in, or that's on the MLS, or that's, you know, at auction or whatever. So really what you got to understand on the front edge of your journey is this is a marketing business, you know, first and foremost, to find opportunities to get in front of sellers of property that should be bought by an investor. So like investment grade property. And so if you get good at marketing and connecting with people, having conversations with those types of sellers, success is inevitable. So I look at this as kind of a marketing business first, and it's a real estate business second. So I think that's how people should look at it.
Great. Yeah, that's wise advice. Now, you've got a great podcast yourself. And if any of the listeners want to tune into that, where should they go? How would they find you?
Yeah, so on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever it is that you like to listen to podcasts, it's called The Real Deals Podcast. It's Deals with a Z. We're going on 6 years now. We've been doing the show. This may be the last year. We'll see. It's been a long run. We're at 302 episodes. You know, it's been a really fun ride, and we're doing one last year here. So go check it out. I've got, you know, episodes on pretty much every topic you could imagine at this point. You know, a lot of outside interviews as well, but there's just a ton of free information that you can get by listening to that show.
Great. And then the name of your app again?
It's called the Driving for Dollars app. The only one that's called that because we have the trademark on it. But it's in the, like I said, in the iTunes store, the Google Play store, depending on whether or not you have an iPhone or Android phone.
Great. Then do you work with investors at all? Do you do any coaching, things like that?
Yeah, we have a full coaching arm to the business. We have an online mastermind group called the Deal Finders Academy that we've had for about 6 years. And then we have a high-end coaching program where myself and another investor that I partnered with that actually owns Open Letter Marketing, a kind of a marketing business for investors. We basically build out your marketing machine for you. We help you execute the marketing, and, you know, we help you take the lead calls and kind of sift and sort the opportunities that come in and try and figure out how to make money from those leads. So that's our other education vehicle that we help other investors with.
Wow. You know, that's so important, because I often talk about high value versus low value work and where you should be spending your time. And you've already nailed it. And if I was a real estate flipper and I was in this market, I'd want to go to someone like you who is actually out there doing it. You see how the market's been changing. You know what's working today versus what was working 6 years ago. Because, I mean, you brought up yellow letters. I still see that today. People are still sending those out, and I think that is the best way to attract buyers. But as you indicated, you know, things have moved on from that, and you need to be to adapt as the market shifts. So I hope everybody that are listening in, that you want to find out more about his services and what he can do for you. You look in the show notes. We'll have a link there so you can contact Tucker and his team and take your business to the next level. Any last points you want to leave with the audience?
You know, this is a great business. It's changed my life tremendously. And, you know, I would say, you know, encourage everybody to get into it, you know, if they want to, but also understand that it's not easy, right? And the world of entrepreneurship is not easy. And so you're going to have some bumps and bruises along the way. It's going to take a little bit of time to get some traction, but stick with it, get over the hump, and you'll be glad you did.
Great. Tucker, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been a great podcast. I know people are going to get a ton of information out of it. And guys, go out there, get his app, at least start with that, and then see where it takes you from there. All right, sir. Thank you.
Appreciate you having me. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.